I'm Emma Freud. This is my rather noisy kitchen. And sitting in it is David Sedaris. 10 million copies of his books are now in print. His public readings are legendary events. And his brilliant, weird, honest and dark writing has been translated into 29 languages. David's been making programmes for the BBC since the late 90s, first from New York, then from Paris, and in more recent years from London. No one knew back in 1996 just how popular and renowned, both nationally and internationally, David would become. But anyone who heard him then had a feeling they'd stumbled on something very special. We're going to be revisiting some of the greatest moments in David's radio archive that's not had a proper airing since its original transmission, and getting to hear again some of our favourite stories, including an unusual edition of Ramblings with Claire Balding, where instead of walking in the open countryside, she collects rubbish with David by the side of an A road in Sussex. I'm hoping that by the end of our 3 hours together, we'll have got a little bit closer to understanding what it means to be David Sedaris. So the first piece that we're going to listen to is from 1997, and it's from your New York diaries, and it's the smoking diary. Do you remember it?
I remember it because it was, I think, the second thing that I had on the radio in America. I had the first thing on the radio, which was a diary I kept while I worked at Santaland at Macy's. And it didn't, and so they put it on the national public radio, and then they said, we want you to be on again. And I thought, oh no, what am I going to do? Because I had never written an essay by that point. I mean, I was writing fiction, and I was writing in my diary all the time, but I couldn't have fiction on the radio. So I turned back to my diaries, and I was smoking at the time, and looked for some essays that had to do with smoking. And it was, I think, just when really things were really starting to change for smokers. You know, they're starting to make it hard for people. Now I'd be so angry if I was still smoking.
Well, you'd be a criminal. You'd be in prison.
Well, I'd just be enraged. So I feel so happy to have quit just because it frees me. All that anger, I was just able to just let it go. And now I have to say, I really don't care. Like if they made cigarettes cost £300 a pack, I don't care.
You said you turned to your diaries. If you hadn't been writing your diaries in order to broadcast them, why on earth were you writing them?
I started keeping a diary in 1977, and I just started one day, and for some reason it took. Then I did it the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. Like, I can't remember the last time I didn't start the day by writing in my diary.
But who were you writing it for?
Myself.
It's not that I don't believe you, I wouldn't be that rude, but when you hear your diaries, which we're about to hear, they don't read like they're written for you. They read like they're written for an audience. They sound like they're all about the listener. They're not notes of your life that you're capturing so that you can look back on them when you're 80 and go, oh, yes, I used to be that person. You're storytelling.
But if you were to read my diary, you know, there's something I wrote in my diary 2 days ago that I made note of because I thought, that's going to work on stage. I know that's going to work on stage. But when I put it on stage, I won't say Amy. The way I would write in my diary, I might write Amy called yesterday. I would say my sister Amy called from New York yesterday. So I'm tailoring it for an audience so they won't feel lost. But if you were to read the original diary entries, they don't include all of that, the little bits that would make it easier for a third party to understand.
Okay, let's have a listen to the smoking diaries. Will you just set the scene for me? You're living in New York.
And it was just that moment when restaurants that had smoking sections were now going completely non-smoking. And this was the first time that someone had ever told me that I couldn't smoke outdoors. And now that's common. You know, you can't smoke in a lot of parks and public places. But this was a first for me, and I was just so outraged by it. But it's funny because it was on National Public Radio. And National Public Radio, it's kind of like a Radio 4 audience. And let's say 10 million people listen to that show. And so if 10 million people listen to that show, 8 of them were smokers. not 8 million, but 8 of them. And so it was one of those situations where I really didn't realize who my audience was. And so people were, their response was swift and immediate. And I did another piece later on about smoking that was just about how I was so furious that people weren't allowing you to smoke in their homes anymore. And again, my sister Gretchen might have applauded me, but nobody else. I just so misjudged my audience.
So here's our first extract from the archive from 1997. This is David Sedaris's New York Diaries.
August 12th. I rode my bike to the boat pond in Central Park, where I bought myself a cup of coffee and sat down on a bench to read. I lit a cigarette and was enjoying myself when the woman seated 12 feet away, on the other side of the bench, began waving her arms in front of her face. I thought she was fighting off a bee. She waved her arms and called out,
"Hello? Hello, excuse me. Do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench?"
I don't know where to begin with a sentence like that. Do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench? There is no we. Our votes automatically cancel one another out. What she meant was, do you mind if I make this a non-smoking bench? I could understand it if we were on an elevator or locked together in the trunk of a car, but this was outdoors. Who did she think she was? This woman was wearing a pair of sandals that are always a sure sign of trouble. They looked like the sort of shoes Moses would have worn, and I looked at her sandals, and I looked at her rapidly moving arms, and I crushed my cigarette. I acted like it was no problem, and then I stared at the pages of my book, hating her and Moses both, the two of them. The trouble with aggressive non-smokers is that they feel they're doing you a favor by not allowing you to smoke. They seem to think that one day you'll thank them for those 15 seconds added to your life. What they don't understand is that that's just another 15 seconds I can spend hating their guts and plotting revenge. I sat on the bench and stared at my crushed cigarette. I figured that if I were to leave, it would give her too much pleasure, so I decided to stay and wait her out. My cigarette looked lonesome on the ground, and I promised it that as soon as this woman left, we could spend some time together. I waited. I waited and waited, all the while craving that cigarette. I thought about lighting up again and saying that it was a non-smoking bench for an hour, and now it was a smoking bench. I had suffered, and now it was her turn. That's the we. We suffer. Some of us suffer more than others. Some of us punish ourselves, and some of us punish others. Her sandals punished my eyes, and my cigarette punished hers. I put out my cigarette, but she did not remove her sandals, so I guess she won. May 27th. My school insurance runs out in a few weeks, so I made an appointment and went for a checkup. I stood around the examining room for 20 minutes, afraid to poke around, as every so often a nurse or some confused patient would open the door and wander into the room. And it's bad enough to be caught in your underpants, but even worse to be caught in your underpants scratching out a Valium prescription on someone else's pad. When the doctor finally arrived, he looked over my chart and said, "Hey, we have almost the exact same birthday. I'm one day younger than you." And that does wonders for your morale. He started in by asking some preliminary questions, and then he said, "Do you smoke?" "Only cigarettes and pot," I answered. He gave me a look and said, "Only cigarettes and pot?" "Not crack," I said. "Never touch the stuff. Cigars either. Nasty habit." January 7th. I was at work defrosting someone's freezer when I heard the Environmental Protection Agency's report on secondhand smoke. It was on the radio and they repeated it over and over again. It struck me the same way that previous EPA reports must have struck auto manufacturers and the owners of chemical plants as reactionary and unfair. The report indicts smokers, especially smoking parents, as being guilty of criminal recklessness, as if these were people who kept loaded pistols lying on the coffee table, crowded alongside straight razors and mugs of benzene. Over Christmas, my sisters and I looked through boxes of family pictures and played Find Mom, Find the Cigarette. There's one in every picture. We've got photos of her pregnant, leaning towards a lit match, and others of her posing with a newborn baby, the smoke forming a halo above our heads. It gave us a warm feeling, these pictures. She smoked in the bathtub, and we'd find her drowned butts lined in a neat row beside the shampoo bottle. She smoked through meals and often used her plate as an ashtray, explaining that we should not attempt to perform this trick in public. Mom's theory was that if you cook the meal and do the dishes, then you're allowed to use your plate however you like. It made sense to us. Even after she was diagnosed with lung cancer, she continued to smoke, though less often. On her final trip to the hospital, sick with pneumonia, she told my father she'd left something at home and had him turn the car around. And there, standing at the kitchen counter, she entertained what she knew to be her last cigarette, and I hoped that she enjoyed it. It never occurred to any of us that our mother might quit smoking. Picturing her without a cigarette was like trying to imagine her on water skis. All of us are left to choose our own quality of life and take pleasure where we find it, with the understanding that, like Mom used to say, sooner or later, something's going to get you. Something got me the moment I returned home from work and Hugh delivered his interpretation of the EPA report. He told me that I am no longer allowed to smoke in any room that he currently occupies. Our apartment is small, 4 tiny rooms. I told him that seeing as I pay half the rent, I should be allowed to smoke half the time we're in the same room. He agreed on the condition that every time I light a cigarette, all the windows must be open. It's cold outside.
Remember, darling, don't smoke in bed.
July 17th. Kevin and I drove his van to Long Island to pick up a load of furniture. The customers, a retired couple planning their move to Florida, had recently held a yard sale and our job was to pick up a bed, 2 dressers, and a desk and deliver them to the buyers in Brooklyn. It was an easy job as we were paid for travel time, and I always liked working with Kevin, riding in his truck, drinking coffee, and listening to stories about him and his communist friends. Kevin is the exception to my all communists are boring rule. He's a fun guy. We drove to Long Island and entered this house where the retired couple had installed brass knockers on all their bedroom and bathroom doors, heavy, substantial knockers cast to picture the polished heads of angry lions. It's a type of thing you might see on someone's front door, but not on the inside. The couple followed behind Kevin and me as we moved the furniture, nervous that we might scratch it. "That's an antique," the husband said, referring to a Mediterranean-style chest of drawers with a chipboard back. "You break it, you bought it." People don't understand that when you're carrying a heavy piece of furniture down a flight of stairs, you already have all the information you need. We loaded the furniture into the truck, covered it with moving quilts, and made our way to the expressway where we drove towards New York. I was making fun of the door knockers when I smelled something dangerous. Kevin said it was probably just an engine fire, and we continued to drive until I noticed garlands of smoke wafting towards a windshield. I turned then to see the retired couple's dresser smoldering like a spent campfire. We pulled over, batting out the small flame that issued from the oily quilt. It was clearly my cigarette that had caused the fire. The glowing butt was right there announcing my guilt. "Look at it this way," Kevin said, spitting his last mouthful of coffee onto the ruined quilt. "It could have just as easily have been my cigarette." He pulled a pack from his shirt pocket and we both lit up before climbing back into the truck for the long ride home. I phoned the nudist colony to make a reservation, speaking to the same fellow who'd mailed me the brochure. I'd imagined tree-shaded bungalows paneled in knotty pine. That, to me, is the essence of the word colony. This place was, instead, a nudist trailer park.
We don't use the word colony anymore because it's too spooky. No, what we have here are trailers. The smaller units run $30 a night, but if you want your own kitchen and bathroom, your only option is a double wide, which will run you an extra $70 a week.
He'd lost me way back. I was still wrestling with the idea of a trailer, and when he introduced the possibility of a roommate, my vision blurred. A roommate at a nudist trailer park. The combination of these elements presented a staggering tableau, made all the more incomprehensible when I heard the man shoulder the phone and raise his voice to shout,
"Mom? Hey, Mom, where's the weekly price list for the two-bedroom rental trailer?"
This person was not only standing around naked in broad daylight, he was doing it with his mother. I heard a screen door slam, followed by the weary voice of a woman shouting,
"Hold your hollering, hotshot. Looking for the weekly price list? You're probably sitting on it, just like the last time. See, I told you so. Whew, somebody needs a shower."
I made my reservation and planned to arrive in 1 week. Day one. I entered a low, clapboard building where 5 fully dressed senior citizens sat hugging themselves against the cold and watching the local news on a color television set bolted to a high shelf. The inhabitants of the room leaned forward in their chairs, biting the ridges of their clenched fists and groaning when confronted with the words, "cold front." They booed the weatherman. They cursed him, and then they pounded on the tabletops, much like prisoners unhappy with their food. On my way to the trailer, I caught sight of various nudists through lit windows, washing dishes and enjoying a quiet evening at home. Curtains wide open, doors unlocked, and there they were with their legs spread apart, chuckling along with the situation comedies. It took a few drinks before, drawing the curtains of my double-wide, I was able to remove my shirt and shoes. The table was littered with beer cans by the time I finally stepped out of my briefs and started to prepare my dinner, trying hard to convince myself that it's natural to grill pork chops in the nude. This is the way they were intended to be cooked. As they sizzled away, I pretended that my roommate had just arrived. "You're just in time," I said, taking 2 plates from the overhead cabinet. "Have a seat. Dinner will be ready in a couple of minutes. Say, don't mind those beer cans. I pulled them out of the neighbor's trash, thinking I'd carry them down to the recycling bin the next time I head into town. Never touch the stuff myself, but then again, that's just me, the health nut. Let me give you a quick look around." I was showing my invisible guest the back bedroom when the smoke alarm went off. The searing, high-pitched squeal sent me into a panic, and before I had time to think about it, I was standing with the door open, brandishing a dishcloth over my head in an attempt to clear the air. Naked. I was drunk and naked for all the world to see. It was a sobering thought that continued to haunt me as I sat down to my blackened dinner. It feels dangerous to drink a cup of hot coffee, and twice in the last hour I've hopped up to brush glowing cigarette ash off what I once considered to be my private parts. Day 2. The sauna, a squat wooden hut, was located beside the pool. A stifling antechamber led to a sweltering hellhole heated by a smokeless cauldron filled with white-hot rocks. Jackie sat upon a wooden shelf, mopping at the sweat that ran down her breasts and over her considerable stomach. She aimed a squeeze bottle towards the cauldron and released a stream of fragrant water upon the rocks, causing the chamber to grow even hotter. "You like that? Can you feel that? Eucalyptus is a healing ointment, very big back in ancient Greece and Egypt. It opened the sinuses of Socrates and King Ramses II, allowing them to concentrate on more important things like democracy and snakes. It frees the mind, eucalyptus. I get some wild thoughts here in the sauna, I don't mind telling you." The eucalyptus had obviously not cleared my mind the way it had hers. Sweat had blurred my vision, and the room had grown so unbearably hot that I could practically hear the blood bubbling in my veins. It occurred to me that I was going to die. Not at some advanced hypothetical stage in my life, but right now. My heart had been steamed, and I'd released so many gallons of sweat that my towel now weighed more than I did. "Out with you," Jackie said. "Go on now, scoot." I left the sauna, spread out my towel, and lay on the concrete patio beside the pool. It was a clear evening, chilly, but the air felt good. I heard a door slam and watched as Jackie waddled back to the clubhouse. She didn't see me lying there, and I saw no point in calling out to her. I'd be fine on my own, lying naked on the ground and thinking things over. Day 3. Returning naked from the sauna this evening, I passed a group of senior citizens who had gathered to watch a game show on the clubhouse TV. "Ask for an E," someone shouted at the screen. "I mean a C, ask for a C." The speaker was a rowdy, white-haired woman with wrinkled, sun-cured skin the color and texture of a blonde raisin. She wore nothing but a pair of bedroom slippers and a cardigan sweater she draped over her shoulders. "I meant a B, that's it. Give me a B." "I wish this show was naked." The woman absent-mindedly ran her fingers over the tabletop. "It would be so much better that way, don't you think? They could take all the money the hosts spend on clothes and make the prizes even bigger. I could play the nude version and make enough money to, I don't know, maybe I'd have someone dredge me a lake and fill it with boats. I like boats. Always did. There's nothing like a boat." I like the idea of that. Filming two separate versions of any given program, one clothed and the other one tailored to capture what the network saw as its vast nudist audience. Day 6. This is Sunday, and looking out my bedroom window, I've noticed that a lot of today's visitors have spent the morning in church. Men, women, and children stand beside their cars, stripping off their sober costumes. The suit jackets and dresses are carefully folded and placed into back seats. This would be a terrible place to get locked out of your car, as the nearest coat hanger is probably a good 15 miles away. It's probably not a very good place to find an iron either, but if you're searching for a Bible, you'd have no problem. Day 7. I got a ride to the bus station with Jackie, whose bumper sticker read, "Nudist on board." She dropped me off with 20 minutes to spare, and I raced up and down the street, passing college students in baggy knee-length shorts and bank tellers wearing navy blue suits. For the first time in what felt like years, I saw stockings and handbags. Bodies, fat and thin, were packed into slacks and pleated skirts. Every outfit resembled a costume designed to reveal the aspirations of the wearer. I found myself looking at these people and thinking, "I know what you look like naked. I can tell by your ankles and the tightness of your belt, the flush of your face, the hair sprouting from your collar, the way your skirts hang off those bony hips. You can't hide it from me." It was as though I'd received the true version of the X-ray specs I'd ordered as a child. The glasses were advertised in the back pages of comic books and promised the ability to see through clothing. I'd counted the days until they arrived and was clinically disappointed to discover that I'd been cheated. The glasses, when worn, gave me the look of someone both enthused and exhausted by what he saw. They suggested the manic weariness inherent in their promise, capturing the moment when, having gorged yourself upon a world of flesh, you discover, too late, that the glasses can never be removed.
From 1997, that was The New York Diaries, written and presented by my guest David Sedaris and produced by Steve Doherty. You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra. I'm Emma Freud, and with me is David Sedaris. The Smoking Diaries went straight into the naked one, where you're in a naturist colony. Do you remember that, when you went to a trailer park?
Yes, that was the only time... I think I can say it's the only time in my life that I've done something in order to write about it.
I was going to ask you exactly that question.
And I did it, gee, it was like 1996. And the hard part was then I had to make it seem like I didn't do it to write about it, right? Like, look, I just wound up at this nudist camp. When I look back on it, I cannot believe that I did it. I mean, I don't even walk around the house in my bare feet. Like, if I could take a bath fully dressed, I would. I am not comfortable with my nudity at all. And I went to this place, and you had to be naked. And it was just upside down universe. Like, I lived in a trailer. And so I remember being in my trailer, and I had clothes on, and somebody knocked on the door, and I panicked. Like, I had to take my clothes off before I answered the door. Because if I answered the door with clothes on, they would have said, what's going on here? I don't think I've ever done anything so outlandish.
Was it because your own life was beginning to run dry for you in terms of you? There was nothing else to mine in your...
No, it wasn't that at all. I was always curious about what that was like, and I'd never read anything about it. And so I thought, well, gosh, why don't I write something about it? And I wish I could do it all over again. I think the writing would be much better.
About the nudist?
Yeah, I haven't read that anything. Gee, I can't bear to reread the things that I've written.
You never go back?
Not if I can help it.
Do you listen to yourself? Do you listen to your broadcasts?
No, I don't. I listened to an interview I gave recently, and I guess that was edifying. I didn't realize I paused so often and just in weird places. I listened to myself thinking, what are you doing? Like, what are you eating? Why are you taking a break in that part of the sentence? I did listen to my last audiobook, and it gave me an idea, the idea of recording my stories and listening to them before I finish a final draft of the book.
Because you can hear the problems.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
I can hear the problems better than I can see them.
Do you like your voice?
I didn't used to like my voice, but I think now that it's just part of the package. You know, like if you were a stand-up comedian and you were criminally handsome, it's not going to work. Because the audience is going to sit there thinking, what does that guy have to complain about? Right? So I look the part that I'm playing in my life, and my voice is perfect for that.
What part are you playing in your life?
Just an observer, I suppose. Just somebody who's non-threatening, somebody who's not remarkable in any way, who is sort of detached and letting things happen and just kind of going along with it.
So were you aware of the irony that in being someone who is not remarkable, you have become remarkable?
I guess that's possible. I don't know. I mean, I'm not in a position to call myself remarkable.
It's just nobody else does it as well as you do. So that's literally the definition of remarkable, isn't it?
But I think in order to do it, you have to be a certain way. You can't have these outstanding qualities. You can't be handed advantages. It's not going to work the same way, right? I mean, I think one of the reasons that people say things to me is that I'm not threatening in any way, right? Hugh and I, my boyfriend and I, we were in Oxford waiting for a bus, and there was this guy going up and asking people for money, and he didn't ask my boyfriend for money. He came right to me, and we had this little altercation, and he said something that so hurt me, right? And it just kind of ruined the rest of my day. And I thought, well, of course he came up to me. And of course he didn't come up to Hugh.
And Hugh's so good looking.
You just wouldn't. There's just something about Hugh. And I don't know, maybe it's because he's tall. I don't know. I don't pose any kind of a threat to anybody. And if I did, I wouldn't have the wealth of material that I have, I suppose.
So the next bit we're going to listen to, it's an edition of Ramblings with Claire Balding. And you recorded it in 2013. Ramblings is when Claire Balding goes out into the countryside and has a long, outward-facing walk through the British countryside with someone who she is interested in as her accompany. It was very different with you, wasn't it? What happened?
Well, she said that we could go wherever I wanted to. And so I said, well, let's go pick up rubbish. And what was interesting about it was that she didn't, I think she was like a lot of people, she didn't really see it. But then when you're walking on the side of the road, then all of a sudden you can't unsee it and you realize it's everywhere, which was no surprise to me. I already knew that. But it was a great way to spend the afternoon. I think especially with, you know, if you're going to take a walk and have a conversation. You know, it's something to talk about, you know, because there's so much garbage on the side of the road. And for the most part, I find the same things over and over and over and over and over again. You know, the other day I went out, okay, 8 bottles of amber-colored urine.
No.
Like in those massive, you know those massive, like, Coke bottles?
Yes.
That is like the size of a fire hydrant. And I'm thinking, how long did you have this in your car? How long did it take you to fill this up? And then people just throw them out the window. So you have to unscrew the lids and empty them. And so, of course, you always get urine on your hands. And then you're out on the side of the road, miles from home, with urine on your hands. And then you're trying to, you know, wash your hands with the grass or wash your hands with dirt. And cars are driving by and they just think, oh, that poor crazy person. Maybe in the United States there are just more places to urinate. I don't know. Gas stations tend to have restrooms. I don't know, but a lot of people here go in their cars
and trucks.
Do you
think it's boys or girls?
Well, I think it'd be pretty hard for a woman.
Well, if it's men, why wouldn't you stop the car and just pee on the side of the road?
I don't know.
It's bizarre.
You know, also a lot of people defecating in their cars.
No.
Out there. Mm-hmm. They'll go into a plastic bag.
No.
Or they'll go into a styrofoam takeout container.
Do you find walking, that as well?
Oh, yeah. I was walking a while ago and I saw a cardboard box on the side of the road. And it was the kind that fruit comes in. And there was a towel over it. And I thought, oh, what do we got here? And I pulled back the towel. And it was the biggest human turd. It was like a yam in this box. And then I thought, okay, this is where I draw the line. But then that night I was lying in bed and I thought, I should have just set the box on fire.
It's quite bizarre how at home you are talking about urine and poo.
Well, if you're out there picking up trash, it's an issue. I mean, you're definitely coming across it. You're coming across plastic bags that people vomit into and throw them out the window. You're coming across a lot of used condoms.
Is that in any way part of the appeal, that you're looking at the detritus of human existence?
No. I mean, it doesn't
interest
me. Do you like
extremes?
I mean, it doesn't interest me, and I try not to think about it, and I try not to glorify it in any way. You know, when people say, oh, you must find amazing things, I don't know what that says about the people in this country.
With a slightly out-of-the-ordinary edition of Ramblings from 2013, here's Claire Balding.
Now, usually on Ramblings, I start by describing the landscape that surrounds us, the weather, the fact that it may or may not rain during the course of our walk. But the thing that stands out right now for me in terms of the visual experience is not what's around us, it's what we're wearing. Because I have been issued with a bright yellow fluorescent vest that says Horsham District Council on it. And one of those litter picker-upper things with a finger on it that you have a little gun element and you can just go along and pick up things off the ground without bending over, which is very useful. And also a hoop onto which is attached a great big black bin liner, because this is not a hobby, this is an obsession for my guest today. I'm walking with David Sedaris, the author, and litter is your thing.
I live for litter. And this equipment, actually, my boyfriend wrote a letter to the council saying, what's going on with all this rubbish? But the counselor that wrote back to us gets involved, and he goes out and picks up litter himself. So we've gone out with him picking up rubbish, and he gave me this equipment.
To be honest, we have got perfect conditions, just wispy cloud up above, hardly any wind, really warm sun and a terrific view. If we look to the south, we've got the shadow of the South Downs. We're in the village of Pulborough in West Sussex, which is about 10-15 miles north of Bognor Regis. So where are we going to walk?
We are going to walk up the road that runs alongside the pub here. I believe it's called Groomers Hill Lane. And it's a beautiful road and it's carpeted with rubbish. Perfect weather to see every bottle cap and every cigarette pack, and it's the same stuff over and over. My boyfriend Hugh found 20 pounds last week. Okay, I've picked up a ton of rubbish for every pound of his, and he found 20 pounds.
So to give you an idea, this is a perfectly pretty country road, a B road. Bit of traffic on it. We've got trees on either side, banks on the side of the road, but it just seems to be a tip. I mean, every three steps there's something to pick up. And here more. Get that bit overboard as well.
And it's not abnormal in any way.
No.
This is completely unremarkable.
You start seeing this as a purpose in life?
We bought a house out here. We only looked at it once. Then we put an offer in, and then I had to go to the United States for work, and they accepted the offer, and then I came home, and all of a sudden we had this house that I'd been in once for an hour. When we bought the house, I hadn't noticed all of the rubbish. And it's not just here. I mean, I've since noticed it's all over.
And do you sort of feel that it's, you can cure it? If you keep picking up, you will stop people doing it?
I have this crazy belief that tomorrow people are going to stop doing it. So I can clean up today because tomorrow all of this is going to change. And I know how insane that is, but if I didn't believe that, then I would just focus on how futile it is.
What did you do with the hubcap? That's a really nice hubcap, that is. Nothing wrong with it.
I could build my own car from all of the parts that I found on this road. Tailpipes, steering wheels.
Yeah. Seats? Have you ever had car seats?
No, I haven't found any yet. Once I found a baby carriage with the seat burned out, you know, like the baby had spontaneously combusted. I found diapers. Loaded diapers. My mother had six children. Why did she never need to throw a diaper out of a car window? She would have thrown the child out of a car window. You know, I used to come home from school and clean my family's house. Four sisters and a brother. And they'd come home from school and they'd, before you, in no time at all, there'd be coats on the kitchen table, and there'd be glasses of milk and potato chip bowls. And I would just,
oh, sorry.
It was like following behind a toddler, you know, trying to keep that house clean. But my own room, because I had my room was so clean. And my sisters would come to my door, and I wouldn't allow them to cross my threshold because I didn't want them to befoul what was really the only clean room in the house. So now I just think of the outside that way. This is something you get a lot. These goddamn little single packets of ketchup and, oh, that's barbecue dip. Okay, someone's eating barbecue dip from a little plastic coffin.
They're poking, they're pushing, you know, chips into it, that's why.
Garbage.
Do you think, and you made the point earlier, that what we don't find the remnants of real food. We find trash food, we find convenience food wrappings, we find rubbish food. Do you think that there's that association? It's rubbish. I don't want this near me anymore. That there's a sort of guilt thing going on that people have eaten it and then go, oh, get rid of it.
I get that feeling a lot. Like I'll find boxes of donuts, you know, maybe with one donut left. And I feel the same thing sometimes with the bottles of the vodka bottles. You know, I just think of some alcoholic driving around and cigarette packs, same thing. You know, just wanting to deny it and just get it away from me.
get it away from me now. I can't wait till I get home. Or maybe they're afraid that if they get home, they're doing something they weren't supposed to be doing, and someone's going to find evidence of it, and they have to get rid of it. I don't know. I've never seen anybody do it. I've never seen anybody throw anything down. I have no idea who we're cleaning up after.
Do you know what your reaction would be if you did see somebody actually wind down their window as they come past us and chuck something out?
If it was an old woman, if it was an old woman or a six-year-old girl, I'd really yell at her. But I'm afraid of anybody else, so I'd just quietly pick up behind them.
Come here. There's a little lid of a plastic bottle that's right down in the... Oh, look, there's two snails in it. Three snails. Oh, well, what should I do? I'll tell you
what.
We
can just empty them out.
Give them somewhere else to go. Are you going there?
That's funny that they made a little home there.
Yeah.
I mean, I gotta say, it's not a bad hobby for me. I do it every day. You know, it's especially good if I'm studying something, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm going to Poland. So, I've been using this audio Learn Polish program. So, I just have my iPod on. And I listen to Polish, or I did it for Swedish last year. And just walk along and pick up other people's garbage and prepare for a trip. And then I go to the other country and I notice how much rubbish there is or is not.
And you're obviously doing it for the good of the community. But is there a bit of you that's also doing it for you? Does it make
I'm
you...
I'm completely doing it for me.
Does it make you feel better?
It does give me a feeling of accomplishment, but more than that, it's because, you know, we bought a house here and this is where I live and the inside of my house is clean. So I guess I feel like I just moved to the outside.
You're listening to Ramblings, and in case you're wondering why doesn't it sound like Claire's in the middle of an empty field with no traffic around, why are we hearing all these cars? It's because I'm not in an empty field. I'm on a road in West Sussex and it's about lunchtime, so quite a lot of traffic going by. And I'm with the author David Sedaris, and we are picking up litter, and we have been doing so non-stop for the last 45 minutes or so. David's already filled up one bag. He's close to filling up the second bag. And it's just really shocking how much there is. Plastic bottles, glass bottles, crisp packets, biscuit wrappers, cigarette packets. When did you first write? Can you remember your first...
I was 20. Mm-hmm. And I still have it. I mean, I just started keeping a diary one day. I didn't know the day before that I was going to start doing it, or that I'd be doing it, you know, it's been 35 years now. And that's what got me started, and then I started reading. Because, you know, you can be a folk artist, and you can live out in the middle of nowhere, and never having seen a painting or a sculpture, and you can make remarkable things. You can't write without reading. You know, that seemed the key. And then once you start reading, you realize that there's a huge difference between what you just wrote and what exists in a book. And then that difference can either break you, you know, or you can think, oh well, you know, you gotta work every day and you'll get better.
How many books have you written now?
Oh, gosh. My eighth book will come out in a few... I turned in... Today is what? Wednesday? Thursday?
Yep.
I turned it in on Wednesday. Like, Wednesday's my last chance to make any changes to it. And it's called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
With owls.
And so they announced the title the other day, and I got an interview request from a diabetes trade magazine in the United States called Diabetes Outlook. I believe that's what it's called. And it doesn't have anything to do with diabetes. I just thought that was just a fantastic name for a book.
Where did you hear the phrase? Where did you come up with that?
I was signing books in the United States, and I love signing books. But I kind of feel when I'm signing books that, you know, in this particular situation, I'm the professional here, you know. So it always surprises me when people tell me what to write. You know, they want me to write, keep laughing. Now, I'm not going to write that in a book. That sounds awful, because I always imagine the book winding up at a charity shop. And if I was at a charity shop and I opened a book and the author had written, keep laughing, I wouldn't want anything to do with it. So this woman wanted me to write to her daughter, explore your possibilities. And so I said, well, I'll keep the word explore. And so I wrote, let's explore diabetes. And then I thought, I'm not done yet. With owls. And then the second I wrote it, I thought, that's the name of my next book. So that's what the book's called.
And there is a girl somewhere in the United States that has a copy of which book was it that you signed? Can you remember?
I think it was When You Are Engulfed in Flames.
So has a copy of that with the title of your next book. That is priceless. That's a proper heirloom. What's your routine for when you're writing? How much do you split? Do you give yourself certain hours at the desk?
I get up and I go right to work. And then I work until lunch. After lunch, I usually get on my bike and pick up rubbish until it gets dark.
Until it gets dark? So how many hours a day are you picking up rubbish?
Well, let's say after lunch. So let's say it's like, I mean, in the winter, it was getting dark like at 4 o'clock. But see, I travel a lot, so I could get everything all tidy. And then I can leave and go to the United States for a month, 2 months. And when I come back, all hell's broken loose.
That bottle is buried. That is... Okay, got it. It's a glass bottle. It's just ended up halfway down to the ground. Come here. Still full. That is full. Not even open. That's elderflower juice or something. Ugh. I think it's wine.
I find a lot of bottles filled with urine.
Oh. I hope that's not what it was. Like I'm going to think it's wine. Can I just live with that misconception?
That's too small of a bottle to
also,
urinate into.
Do you know what the seal was still sealed? It wasn't urine.
But our Greek grandmother lived with us when we were growing up. That woman would throw anything out a car window.
Would she?
As long as it fit. That was her only criteria. And my father, we had this campaign in the United States at that time. It was a Keep America Beautiful campaign. And it showed an Indian in a canoe rowing to the shore, you know, and passing all this trash in the water. And then he lands it at like a dump. And then there's a single tear running down the Indian's face. And that had such a profound effect on people of my generation. And that's when it really sort of turned around. Like, you remember that episode of Mad Men when they go on a picnic? And they go on a picnic and then they just shake the blanket under the ground and leave. And that's the way it used to be. And then it got tidy. But it seems like England's gone in the other direction. Like it used to be tidy, and then it turned into this.
So David Sedaris has now removed his fluorescent woolly cap, has his bright orange backpack on, and a third bin liner attached to a hoop to his hip, and is leaning over picking up rubbish. And this series of ramblings was sort of nominally about self-improvement. This walk about improving your environment, but as David has admitted, it also, he feels it very beneficial to him. He loves the concentration, the focus of it. We're walking north out of Pulborough, the sign telling us that the road is about to get narrower. The banks on either side, to the casual glance, look typically rural, covered in leaves, and we've got the gnarled roots of a tree just in touching distance on the left. Thistles starting to grow over. But as soon as you start looking closer, You see the rubbish. You see crushed cans and discarded crisp packets. And that's what we're after. We're not looking for the beautiful today. We're looking for the ugly and removing it.
Is bending down good exercise?
I think if you keep your core muscles, you can try and keep your core muscles tight. It is. Otherwise, you put a bit too much pressure on your back. I only know that because I've recently started Pilates, and that's what they've told me. So I repeat it with confidence.
You
sort of hold your abs in and your pelvic floor up as you bend, and then that's fine. Hey, look, we're another step on the way to building our car, because there's the rear view mirror.
So we've got two hubcaps, a rear view mirror. I'm surprised we haven't found a license plate yet.
Yeah. I tell you, you end up stretching a lot as well, so it's not just bending down. We're stretching over to get things that are high on the bank. It is good. I think we should bring out a video. We'll custom make some music for it. You write it all. And we'll release it to the world. How litter can improve, or litter picking up can improve your life. Get fit with litter. Fitter with litter, obviously. That's what it is. I tell you, though, I have to have a little fix. I have to have a reward. Can we just walk to the edge here? Because then we get the full view. So just coming off the road and partly up somebody's drive. In fact, there's a footpath that goes down here between these fields.
I'm always surprised when I find rubbish on footpaths. I don't know. I mean, I guess I associate them with ramblers. I think of ramblers as people who take their litter with them.
I wanted to just come off the road really to get the view, because we've got a little bit of height here which allows us to look across the flat plain and towards the South Downs. And I know that the other side of that, one can see the channel.
You can see it when you hike to the top there.
Yeah.
You can look over and you can see it.
I mean, it really is a lovely area of the country. You know, you said this is your idea of perfect beauty. And when you look at that, what do you see?
Tell you the truth, I see all the rubbish that we're not seeing right now. I mean, I feel like that's the problem. I feel that people look at that and then they say, that is so beautiful. Oh, it's so beautiful. And then people say, how was it? And they say, oh, it's really beautiful. Because that's what they're looking at, the long view. And they're not looking down at the ground, which is covered with rubbish. And so they're thinking, that's not a problem. I went there and it was beautiful.
Good afternoon. What's this, lunch?
Hello.
Is it all ladies?
I'm a guy.
Oh, right. I can't see, I'm afraid.
Oh.
No, we've been picking up litter, so.
Oh.
But we just dived off the road to have a look at the view.
I'd volunteer to help on that if I could see.
Would you? Yeah, no, you have to.
I have picked up newspapers up here.
Yes.
And dragged them all the way home, actually. There's no way to put them.
Yeah, we filled three bags so far.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Makes you ashamed of the country, doesn't it?
A little bit.
But who do you think does it?
Well, how do you mean? It's volunteers, isn't it?
No, I mean, who do you think throws the rubbish down?
Well, they throw everything out of a car now, don't they? Doesn't matter what it is. If they don't want it, it's out the window. That's most of the litter, I think.
I've never seen anybody do it, so I just want a face to put to it, I suppose.
No, I've seen a Coke can come out of a very modern Audi.
Huh. One day I found two bags of household rubbish on the side of the road. So I carried them home, and I went through them. And the person had topped up their mobile phone in Chichester. And so they had their mobile phone number. So I called the police. And I said, we got to call this person. And they said, well, the problem is, unless they've called us, we don't know who it is. I said, it doesn't matter. You call and say you got your eye on him. And he said, but I don't. I said, well, you say it anyway. He said, that's a great idea. So he called and just told the fellow that we had our eye on him. But that was a lucky break. But that was just, somebody took the rubbish from home and just, I don't know why, they couldn't wait for a trash day or something and just threw it out into the woods.
Well, my parents were both Cumbrians, so I have some affinity with the Lake District. But you get litter on top of the mountains there. beer cans, and they climb up the fell with a full beer can, sucked it and dropped it up there. You can't believe it, can you?
No,
They've gone up there to admire the view and all the rest of it.
And then totally disrespected it by leaving that behind.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So where are you walking to?
I'm only going home to Pulborough. Victory Lane. I've just been out to Nutbourne. I do this most days.
Have a good walk. Thank you.
Bye.
Did you see the slug coming out of there?
Slugs coming out of the
smell
beer.
It? Smell that slug?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's really... Yuck.
That's the nastiest
God, thing. God, I can really smell
How
it.
How much would I have to pay you to drink that?
No!
Protect your lips?
Stop it. Don't even say that.
I like how angry you got.
I've walked about 25 yards in front of David, and turning around looking back at him, he's disappeared into the hedgerow. He's having to bend and claw to get through branches to retrieve a can that he saw halfway up the bank. It's amazing the energy that he brings to it, that the intensity of his drive. I must find... He's digging down into the ground now, pulling out some plastic from that's completely buried. But I must find it. I must get rid of this. I must clean this landscape. Are there things, David, that you're sort of really desperate to find?
A dead body.
Really? Gosh. Of the many answers that were possible, that's not the one I thought you'd say.
Well, it would just be really... It would be so rewarding. You know, if you found a wallet and it had money in it, you'd have to turn it in. So you'd either have to find just a bag of money. But if I had a choice between finding a bag of money, finding a body, I think I'd rather find a body. I wouldn't tell anyone about it.
You wouldn't?
No. That would be funny if you didn't.
Well, it's been a very different ramblings for me. Usually, you know, I'm looking up and out and beyond, and I feel that I've, you know, looked deeper and more in more detail and had a purpose and actually done something different but constructive. I feel quite tired, actually, mentally tired, not physically tired.
Huh.
But because I've been concentrating. And it's been fun. It's been very different. And next week I will be doing something I've never done before on Ramblings, which is walking barefoot near Weston-super-Mare.
Watch out for broken bottles.
From 2013, that was Ramblings with Claire Balding, and the producer was Karen Greger. It was very nice to have you here. Thank you very much indeed for being here, for being David Sedaris, for being honest, for being funny and for being real. Being David Sedaris was produced by Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Indeed it was.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little.
Soul Music on BBC Radio 4 Extra, the series about pieces of music with a powerful emotional impact.
I wonder why.
Burnell was a gunner on a B-17, and when he wasn't on duty, he spent it at Dent's Road with me. That's where I lived. We went dancing. We went to the Corn Exchange here in Bedford, where Glenn Miller used to play. We loved going to the pictures, so we went there frequently. Then we'd go to London. I spent 2 days in London with him, and we stayed the night together at the Red Cross. We managed to get a room. We went sightseeing. I went to the Lyceum Ballroom, and we danced and danced and danced. Every time we say goodbye, we'll